Broadcasting from a tiny studio located somewhere in North America to the world. Waging war on the matrix of confusion.
Fires and light the fires.
I know one of them has is carrying a very large weapon.
I am really deeply worried. We have two grandchildren who are 6 and 8, and I believe they are in greater danger of dying from enemy activities than we were.
There's no reason that young American soldiers need to be going into the homes of Iraqis in the dead of night.
The United States must secure its borders. This is a basic responsibility.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
The hard part about playing chicken is knowing when to flinch.
And now, Dark Matters. Here's Don Ecker.
I hear it fading, I can't speak it, oh, else you will dig my grave. Feel them finding, always.
Welcome back to a brand new edition of Dark Matters Radio. I am your host. My name is Don Ecker, and joining me in this special broadcast today is a very good old friend going back many, many years, somebody that is extremely knowledgeable about the UFO enigma, somebody that we've had on the program in the past, my good friend Richard Saraday. Richard, thanks for joining us, and it's great to have you back.
Hey, Don, how are we doing? About to close out 2009 here. It's great to get together and have a chance to kind of review and reflect on this anomalous subject.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you what. Talk about reflecting. The last couple of days, I've been just a little tied up with a little virus, and I've been reflecting that, but I think I pretty much have it on the run.
Yeah, I can tell you have the residual sort of huskiness, but that suits you.
Hey, Rich.
Yeah.
We're talking today about, as a matter of fact, hey, look, not too awfully long ago, a couple of months ago, you joined me here in studio where we discussed one of my classic UFO Tonight's shows. Actually, it was one that you appeared on along with another guy, Mike Younger. And I got to tell you, the response to that was very, very interesting. The listeners that tuned in to hear that show were pretty much taken with it. Now, of course, this topic, this subject, this field of UFO research is one that has always had been overshadowed by hints of intelligence, counterintelligence, a subject that has been followed probably very covertly by members of the military / intelligence / industrial complex. And this is something that you yourself have been involved in for a long time. And hey, would I be amiss to suggest that at one point you almost became swallowed up by this?
Emotionally, it's like flying blind. It's like you throw yourself down a blind alley, knowing that you're entering a blind alley, and you're just hoping that you can ferret something out worthwhile, because the layers of, it's like peeling an onion, the layers of information and disinformation, you have no way of gauging it. The only way I could get it was just by hanging in there and just by gathering more and more information from many different sources and comparing what they say, you know. But many a time you're adrift in a field. It's almost like playing a murder mystery game. You don't know who's for real and who's not, and who did it and who done it and who not. You don't know, and you don't know what's going to happen to you. There's so many hoaxes and scams and fear mongering and.
Well, you know, in the last few years, you've taken a rather large step backwards from this.
Yeah.
I mean, your career path has gone in a completely different direction. I mean, these days you're a high school, if you don't mind me saying, a high school teacher.
No, not at all.
And that, as a matter of fact, that's also a very, very far cry from what you originally did back in the 70s and 80s, where you were a major television film star.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, though, I started off in high school setting out to be a college professor. That's what I wanted to do. The career in acting really came out of the blue, so to speak. It's like I kind of got dragged kicking and screaming into it, actually, for a long time. But then it was like, once you commit to it, you spend many years struggling just to get work. You know, it's a really, really tough field.
Well, I just, as a matter of fact, recently, within the last several months, saw the film Midway on the Tube, which you were one of the pilots in there. And
yeah.
Are you still getting residuals for that?
Oh, yeah, I do, man. It's, with the residual and a dollar, I can get a cup of coffee. But, you know, that was really special, and I just want to acknowledge Walter Mirisch and his son, Drew Mirisch. Walter was the producer of that movie. I was back in 1975, and I was waiting tables. I had one job previous to that. I'd finally gotten my guild card and played a guy in a lineup, an original series called The Blue Knight with William Holden. And then Midway was my next job. And really how it came about was amazing. I don't want to get off on showbiz, but again, I just want to thank Walter Mirisch, who's passed now, and his son Drew. I was doing graduate film studies at UCLA, and I became kind of king of the student movies there. Guys would walk up and say, would you consider doing my script? You know, it's like the place you want to be in big Hollywood. And but Drew saw a film I did for one of the other graduate students, Marty Olstein, and that won a bunch of awards, and actually borrowed the film from from Marty and took it home and set up the projector in his house. And after dinner, he showed it to his father and said, Dad, I got this fine young actor here. You think you got a part for him in your new movie? You know, and that's how I got the part in Midway. It was really amazing.
Well, that was a great movie, and for anybody that catches that film, I can even tell you now, and believe me, this was not a setup, Richard was in Strawberry 12.
Yeah, co-pilot.
Co-pilot in Strawberry 12, which was one of the flying Catalina boats looking for the Japanese fleet.
Yeah, looking for the Japanese fleet and hoping they don't shoot back.
Hey, Rich, now, talking about the reason why we're really here, which is overall the UFO enigma phenomena. I guess in one way you could say I kind of, without getting crude, I kind of copped your cherry back in the very early 90s with this. Would that be accurate?
That would be absolutely accurate. It's like I had been reading on my own and dealing with the issue, I'd say, from about, well, it's always been around in my life, my whole life, interest in UFOs and I don't know how to explain that, except, you know, we're all kind of taken with it back in the 50s when I was growing up, and rockets and everything else, and I really wanted to be a rocket builder back then. I used to build rockets. Me and my buddy used to build them from scratch and launch them, and, you know, we designed our first clubhouse, which was shaped like a flying saucer. Execution was a little weak. We didn't have quite the engineers the military-industrial complex has, and we couldn't find the anti-grav drive, but other than that, it was a great flying saucer. But really, back in the 80s, as I began to transist, you hit late in your career as an actor, and the work starts really drying up, getting less and less, And I was looking, I had a young family, looking for a way to stabilize it, but I really wanted to try to develop my own properties and my own scripts. And what interested me was the UFO field, and that's how we met. You know, I followed up on, after reading UFO magazine for a couple of years, and contacted you guys in Sunland, and you and I met over coffee and came to an agreement that we'd try to see what we could do to develop some stuff here. And I was totally, you know, naive and ignorant, and like you say, you really popped my cherry on the subject and pointed me in many different directions I had never thought of exploring to really broaden and deepen my understanding of the contradictions and you know, absurdity of the field, and how it's very dangerous to latch on to one interpretation because someone come along and slap you in the back of the head and make you look just the other way.
Well, back in those very early days, now I guess we would probably not be remiss to mention what stories were really populating the field then. I, you know, still yeah. the Bill Moore MJ-12 stuff. John Lear was certainly a very public figure. William Cooper was another very public figure. Linda Howe. I mean, all these names were swirling about in the mix. After you really became involved at that time, what, I guess the best way to say it is, what conclusions did you draw then as opposed to what conclusions you draw now today?
Well, I guess I would say, I kind of jumped in with the extraterrestrial hypothesis, assuming this is obviously extraterrestrial. These are obviously advanced civilizations visiting us, and that was the predominant view I had, and it was looking for those results in my research. And of course, as you know, you can also define what you're looking for in this field, so to speak, in your interpretation of it.
But well, isn't that always a danger?
Yeah, it is a danger, and it's very easy, and it's we do it so seamlessly in the UFO field, so easily and so seamlessly, you know, we don't question our assumptions. We have to kind of keep broadening our view and deepening our view. It's really, between what's really happening, the deception of the phenomenon itself, which is highly deceptive, and then you might say the protection of the public from getting a clear picture of it, which is, I think, a high agenda of the intelligence community to keep the public, you know, from taking this seriously or getting a clear picture of it, or maybe perhaps even joining them and not having a clear picture of it, which makes them insecure since they're supposed to be in charge. All those things come into play, you know what I'm saying, in trying to interpret the phenomena. But, you know, what I learned from you, and, like, remember you handed me the Mothman prophecies to read. And once you read the Mothman prophecies, you start scratching your head again, you know. And then you read, and you read in there about John Keel's interpretation of electromagnetic spectrum and how things might, you know, coalesce in this dimension, sucking energy from it, which creates the cold spots. All these different things, these little things you think about, you know. And you read, then you read about the Hudson Valley stuff and the big giant triangles appearing over Hudson Valley some years ago in the 80s, and then Philip Imbrogno's research into it and him touching into and discovering that there is some kind of correlation between the appearance of these crafts and ancient sites, these, you know, little sites all over the New England area, which may have been established many, 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 many hundreds of years ago, that seemed to mark something, some sort of portals or something. And J. Allen Hynek was also interested in exploring this possibility. And getting your head stretched and pushed in different directions where the extraterrestrial hypothesis becomes questionable and any other explanation becomes, huh? You know, it's just, it's a bigger and more complex subject than the human mind can contain. And just trying to share enough information and to try to separate the phenomena into discrete groups so you can kind of isolate what is this an expression of or what's that an expression of is almost an impossible task.
Well, now let me break in here for just a second. And let me kind of throw a curveball at you. And this is a question that I've asked myself recently. As a matter of fact, just how relevant is this today? When you take a look around at what is happening, or should I say, what the media is telling us is happening. This underpants bomber that just tried to destroy an aircraft flying into Detroit. The economic slowdown now. I mean, you know, California, where you and I both live, we now have unemployment in the double digits. I mean, you know, everything else around us seems to be going to hell in a handbasket, Rich.
Yeah.
So we ask the question again, just how relevant is this? Are we, in your opinion, are we spinning our wheels?
Well, you know, I ask myself that question all the time, too, Don.
Of course, now this is...
enough, I just got the latest issue of UFO Magazine. It finally showed up in my mailbox the day before yesterday. And, you know, William Burns... about, you know, some of the same things we're talking about here, and also about the vagaries of the issue, and he seems a little hurt by a lot of criticism his efforts on UFO hunters is getting from bloggers and stuff like that.
Speak up just a little, Rich.
Oh, he's getting you know, Burns writes about the criticism he's taken on the on his show UFO Hunters, you know, and he kind of tries to address that in his publisher's note in his latest issue of UFO Magazine. You know, how everybody declares himself an expert and can say anything they want over the air and don't understand the nature of television and why we aren't getting, you know, I don't know what people picture. But this is an extremely difficult field to try to come up with anything concrete on, you know. As far as its relevance, I don't know, you know, you tossed around and you have for many years and you are a very sharp thinker and a man with a good investigative background and a great nose for bullshit. You know, which is extremely important in this field. But I would say that it may not be relevant in the, you know, if you drew concentric circles around a target and where we are right now being the center, you know, it's priorities. I mean, what are our priorities? I'm sure that, you know, the people dealing with this in the governmental level also view this as a list of priorities, how to deal with this subject and the public's relationship to it. You know, all that stuff is a level of priorities. But if you fix your concentric circles, and we say, how relevant is it? I would say to our immediate concerns as we try to deal with the unemployment and the rocking the economy and the misbehavior of Wall Street and the divisiveness, the polarization of people's attitudes, it's not very relevant. On another level, I think it's extremely relevant because I think behind the world stage, the power of this phenomenon and what the powers that be have learned about it and from it is extremely influential in shaping a global policy that in ways that we're not aware of.
Well, you know, it's funny.
I can't prove it, but that's what I think.
It's funny you should mention that because some time ago, while going through my vast archives of previous radio shows, which incidentally, Rich, you were a very big part of back in those days. I don't know if you recall. And of course, I edit out, you know, ads and that kind of thing. But back in the early days, I mean, you were all over that show.
Yeah, yeah. That was a very interesting time. Now, you know, it's interesting during that time because these things are just bursting on the scene, you know, after a long, quiet period. I think everybody had been lulled to sleep by the Air Force Blue Book final conclusions that there's nothing here to look at, boys. Just move on down the road. Nothing here to look at. And it kind of rocked everybody back into a sense of complacency about it. And then in the Rendlesham Forest incident in Britain in 1980, followed up later, I mean much later, by Lazar, I think it was 88 or 89. When did Lazar come out?
Yeah, 88.
Yeah. And in between those two things, we had Bubba, you know, down in Pensacola.
Right.
Which, by the way, I went for a vacation with my family down to Destin two summers ago, and we were on the sixth floor of a condo facing the beach, and my nephew goes, we're sitting on this big balcony overlooking the ocean, and there's a beach and there's a pier out in front of us, and my nephew, Mason, goes, what's that? And I look up, and... there it is. There's Bubba. I mean, it's clear as a bell, you know, bouncing around.
A UFO?
Generating a mist, whatever that they called Bubba, that the whole Pensacola sightings.
Right.
You know? And so I was just saying that you go from Rendlesham to Pensacola to Lazar, those three stories woke a lot of people up and made them pay attention, right? That's the way I see it. I mean, the way I experienced it.
Well, you know, I didn't want to get sidetracked with my original thought. So I'm going through my archives of past radio programs, and one that I pulled out, I digitized it and then uploaded it here on the Paracast, was a show I did with author William Bromley. Now, why do I mention
that?
The
Gods of Eden.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And you just said that on the one hand, this stuff is not very relevant. On the other hand, it may be very relevant behind the scenes. And that was the entire thesis of what Bromley talked about in that book, how humanity may have been manipulated by this phenomenon for eons.
Yeah, I see. And you also turned me on to that book, Don, The Gods of Eden, you know. And you've got to read these books if you're entering the field, I think, to stretch your mind into areas it wouldn't find itself stretching into, to wrap your head around this thing, you know. And it just doesn't make it any easier. It just makes it more complicated, but it makes it more honest. There are just so many different avenues to be investigated that are all truly occult. When I say occult, the little meaning of the word occult is hidden, you know, hidden. And I think that the fact that the phenomenon itself chooses to play peekaboo with us all the time is in itself a very manipulative thing that the phenomena does, you know. So it's very hard. We're kind of like somebody standing over us. We're in a maze, like a rat in a maze, and it's up there going, hey, let's see if we close this little avenue here, what they do. Oh, let's see if we open it here, what, you know. Yes. In other words, we're in a position of not knowing the game that's being played on us, either by the government or by the phenomenon itself.
And exactly, yes.
In somewhat the same position, so, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, Rich, as much as I hate to break your train of thought, I got to stop here. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, more with my special guest, my very longtime buddy and friend, Richard Saraday. Back. My name, Don Ecker, the show, UFOs Tonight. Hey, Rich.
Time slip.
I had a brain fart. Dark Matters Radio. And we are
the new
back.
Incarnation.
Oh, my God. Hey, speaking of reincarnation, ladies and gentlemen, this past Christmas Eve, Richard and his very lovely wife, Gloria, invited Vicki and I up for some Christmas Eve celebrations. And we had not only a delicious dinner, but we had some sparkling conversation. And one of the topics, Rich, that we covered, you and I, involved the subject of reincarnation. And I told you about that video that I had seen with that young boy that apparently at least he and his parents believe he's the reincarnated spirit of a World War II fighter pilot that was killed during the Second World War. Now, although I've got to tell you that topic has always fascinated me, when it comes to really delving into it, I'm kind of a novice at best. Now, you, on the other hand, over the years have studied various meditation disciplines and what have you. What are your feelings about something like that?
Well, I can approach from two points of view. One is subjective, which is, you know, my own personal efforts to explain my own experiences, and secondly, just as a person standing back like anybody else saying, well, you think we're born again? You think we're born again? You think that's possible?
Hey, you got to speak up, my friend.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. There's two points of view. One is you try to reconcile your own experience, your own dreams, your own memories, your own thoughts with, let's say the existing paradigm, which is, you live, you die, and if you're a religious person, if you live a good life, you go on to a better life. If you're an atheist, which is just someone who goes, well, I don't believe or disbelieve, I just don't see the evidence, that's another viewpoint. And then there's the third viewpoint, which is like scientific reductionism, which says all there are is chemical processes, and consciousness arises from that and goes away when the chemical processes stop. So there is no continuity. Of course, all those things are investigatable to a certain extent, but not to an absolute scientific degree, although I think we're getting closer and closer. But, just like the UFO field, there's abundance of anecdotal evidence of, people claiming previous lives. And interesting enough, it happens quite dramatically with very young children.
Children, wouldn't you say children have not yet been conditioned?
Yeah.
To not believe?
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good way to put it. They have not been conditioned to not believe their own experience or their own thoughts, their own, their own inner truth,
Kind of like the Wizard of Oz. Don't pay any attention to the man behind the curtain.
Yeah, exactly. And so the kid doesn't know any better. He just says, well, gee, I remember this. I remember that. I remember that I lived on this street, and there was this neighbor who his name was so-and-so, and his wife used to babysit me. And often the parents have thought, well, this is interesting and bizarre and charming and, go to sleep now. But then some parents, realize it might be something more to it. And there have been several cases where it's been, demonstrated that they've actually taken the kid to the place where he claims to have known these people, and he recognizes them, and he can tell about their history and what was happening. And in this case I'm talking about, it was a case I saw on one of the cable channels dealing with this issue, and this kid was he was born with a red mark on his forehead, upper right-hand side of his forehead, I think, or upper left-hand side, in a village in India. And as he grew up and got to be 4 or 5 years old, he began talking about his other family and his children and things like this, which was extremely bizarre for a little kid to talk about. But he could recall everything and describe the village and everything else. And eventually they figured out what village this was. And they went to the village with the child. And the child recognized his previous family. He could even tell how he died, which was he was working in a warehouse and some thieves came in to rob the warehouse. And he got shot in the head, in the upper right-hand side of his head. Interestingly enough, this is one of those cases where almost at the moment of the death of this guard in this neighboring village, a baby's being born. And
so there was virtually no time lag between...
Yeah, it was like one of those cases where it was like, out and in immediately, and I think those are the cases where the memories are strongest, because there hasn't been time in the between incarnations to digest previous experience or to detach from it and to prepare for a new experience, a new birth. I think it was just sort of like wham, wham, almost like a continuous thing for the soul. And so it's still carrying the imprint of its last life and its memories.
Wow. That is some fact. But why is it, do you think, that so many of these stories seem to come out of India, of all places?
Well, I think that's very, first of all, they embrace reincarnation, so they don't have the paradigm that says, no, that's ridiculous. So I think it's more when a kid says this, people are more willing to listen to it, I think that helps.
And do you think
kids are more inclined to talk about it because there isn't this sense of, since you were born in this particular Western paradigm, the group thought is you die and then, you decide whether you go to heaven or hell.
Which is basically a Christian concept.
Right. Yeah, Christian and the whole dualism, that whole path. And you can trace that back through Egypt, and the duat, good and evil and weighing the soul, against a feather. all that, that duality idea.
Right, sure. Well, you know, for what it's worth, and who knows?
Yeah, keep me on target here, because my mind will roam all kinds of ways.
It's not anything here or there, but you know, I accept the idea of reincarnation.
Yeah.
You know, until
if it happens to one person, does it happen to every person?
Exactly. The other thing also, I believe, is that is it not true? Is it not a law that nothing is ever truly lost in this universe of ours? That it just changes?
Law of conservation of energy, right?
Exactly.
The burgeoning field of quantum physics has really opened our minds to just how rich and complex consciousness is. The fact that there are scientists working on CERN on the big collider project,
the super collider, yeah,
right. I mean, there are actually scientists who worry about how their thoughts are affecting the experiment. You follow me?
Yes, I do.
At the quanta level, you know, where thoughts influence matter, and there are hardcore, quantum physicists who are looking very, very closely at this and trying to figure out that relationship, because it's already been established with the two-slit experiment that attention and awareness affects, at the quanta level, the behavior of the quanta.
Well, you know, Rich, that's... Let me kind of veer off now into a different level. I mean, still keeping some of the basic concepts in mind, but back in the days when I was doing UFOs Tonight, you were very active in the overall UFO gestalt, if you will.
Yeah.
I'm sure you remember that at that time I butted heads with many, many skeptics over the concept that unidentified flying objects, while I never said they are proof of extraterrestrial visitation,
right,
that there is certainly something there that needs to be studied, investigated, and some determinations be made about. Now, I'm sure you'll recall that people like Phil Klass, people like Joe Nickel, later Michael Shermer, Jim Oberg, I mean, all these guys are basically deniers that there is any truth to this phenomenon. Now, I guess what I want to...
Shermer's pretty easy to dismantle,
Well, yeah, I've done it.
On a level playing field, I mean, Shermer is almost easier to dismantle than a contactee, you know? His hidden assumptions are so blatant, anybody who's really paying attention, that it's astounding to me that the guy considers himself a rational human being.
Well, he publishes Skeptic Magazine.
Yeah, well, only it's not a true Skeptic Magazine. It's a set of believers with a different set of beliefs that they're going to hang on to no matter what, regardless of the evidence. So I don't consider them to be true skeptics in the sense of... I think you're more of a true skeptic than Michael Shermer is.
Well... there is tons of things that I am very skeptical of and about.
Yeah.
But as you know, I finally, myself personally, I reached a saturation point with this, and had to step back from it. Now, I've had folks since then, especially in light of these radio programs, come up to me and say, "Ah, Ecker, we knew it. You couldn't stay away." You know? And as I said originally when I left, that, hey, look, this subject itself, the topic, I've never lost an interest in or a fascination of. But what I really did was I got... And, I'll be blunt. I just got sick of butting heads with the dickheads that surround this field. And there are a lot of them out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That makes this feel so difficult. Again, that's also well spoken for, by the way. I mentioned the new issue of UFO Magazine, Bill Burns' editorial. He covers that issue also, Don.
What's that?
Well, you know, that there is something here, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you...
It's out there, and that it seems like the operating, and even as I'm speaking, I'm participating in it myself. The ripping and shredding that done among and by UFO researchers of each other.
Well, you know, Burns, to give Burns his due.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one thing about me. Now, I certainly, over the years, I've had issues with Bill. I've always said a couple of things about Bill Burns. Number one, I highly respect Bill's intellect. Bill is an extremely intelligent guy. Where we butted heads with was his acceptance when he became part of the magazine, his acquiescence to letting what I considered to be highly questionable folks come in there spouting their nonsense without, separating the wheat from the chaff. And believe me, today there's a hell of a lot of chaff there. But, you know, to give him his due about the TV show, you know, a lot of folks thought that UFO hunters really lacked substance or gravitas, if you will.
I have some thoughts about that myself in support of Bill, actually, because you and I know about this, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
You and I tried this, back in the 90s.
A lot of what Burns was blamed for, he literally had no real control over.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the cases that they went after, although had I been a part of that process, and of course I was not, I would never have been allowed within a mile of their production. They probably had an extraordinarily limited budget.
Oh, and yeah, I mean, I don't think people understand, like he says, the nature of television and trying to do what we call a documentary. The hundreds of hours of footage you shoot and acquiring that hundreds of hours of footage is a long, tedious process. And then the even longer, tedious process is trying to select from those 100 hours a few minutes of relevant stuff to try to, you know, to tell your story. And you've got all the requirements that the networks or whoever is paying for it is putting on you to keep heads in front of the screen. You've got a format which is quite ritualized. You know, there are many difficulties to this process that I don't think the public just recognizes. And a lot of the people spouting off on the internet who consider themselves, you know, part of the UFO field, I guess you just sit down, put on a hat with UFO in the front, and say, "Okay, I'm a UFO investigator." Whatever, you know.
Well, Rich,
the thing I respect about him, I'm going to say this about Bill and about other people like him. You have to respect these people. Bill has spent his life, I mean, when you say spent his life, that means getting up, you know, pouring your energies into, confronting it, creating your path as you go. And he has made a living, and more than that, he has contributed a lot of information that we would not be aware of otherwise through his efforts and through his dedication, you know. And, if some of us, you know, disagree with conclusions or things like that, that a researcher who puts that much time and effort into it has, well, that's fair enough, and we can all discuss the interpretation of it. But we don't even have that interpretation without these guys going into the field and doing the legwork, you know, actually doing the fucking nitty-gritty. Pardon my French, I didn't mean to let that slip out. But, that's the real test of this field, is the guys who go into the field at whatever cost and whatever beating they take, but try to get down there and try to figure something out and try to get some closer look at it. And the closer you look at this field, the more difficult it makes it on you to get a clearer look.
Well, let's pick up there when we come back. I've got to take another quick break, Rich.
All right.
And then I have something from one of my audio tapes that, quite frankly, surprised the hell out of me when I discovered it when I was going through and reviewing it. And I would like to play it for you and discuss it a little bit.
Good, and I'd also like to turn the tables on you a little bit when we come back and ask you for your opinions on a few things.
Okay, so everybody stand by. My guest, Richard Saraday, and I will be back in just a moment. And we are back. Oh, I didn't mean to cut that off that quick, but by God, when you're doing live radio, who knows what's going to happen. Rich, we are back. Now, the last time you and I got together to do this, one of the topics, as a matter of fact, the only topic we really covered was a guy that you knew quite well. I knew, I guess you could say, slightly. A fellow by the name of Michael Younger. As a matter of fact, the show that we did back in the 90s with him is up on the Paracast today, called Spies, Lies, and Audio Tape. You came in studio here and helped me with an opening monologue about this show.
Yeah.
Now, I was going back through some tapes here, and the guy that I really cut my teeth with in radio here in Los Angeles was a legendary TV radio talk guy by the name of Jim Hawthorne.
Yes, an L.A. institution.
Right. Well, he passed away several years ago. And back in those days, 91 and 92, we ended up doing something that he called the UFO Show on KIEV in Glendale. Now, during the period of time, which was a number of months that I was going over there, the show was once a week on Saturday night. We developed a huge following. It was really surprising, the public's appetite for this information. And what I tried to do was to bring in guests that were sane, okay, sane, knowledgeable, you know, and somebody that could really enlighten the public. And like any show, Hawthorne took live calls. Now, here I am, I'm going through there and listening to this tape, and I'm making a decision. Is this one I want to include in the archives or what? And lo and behold, I heard a voice that I recognize today. Now, at the time, this guy meant nothing to me. I didn't know who he was. He was going by the name of Mike, and he was just another caller that called in. But then I started thinking about this, and it came to me, just how long was this guy involved in this subject topic? And was he following me, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was following you, and he was also, you know, the Billy Goodman happening. Remember that?
Oh yeah,
that's when he jumped in with both feet. But before that, he was listening to, you know, you every time you were on.
Okay, now that kind of that in a way that's kind of creepy. Okay.
Well, you got to remember though, there is, I mean. You were the avenue to discuss this subject. I mean, there was nothing else out there.
Well, okay, let's just take five here for a second. Let me play a little bit of this.
Sure.
This phone call from Hawthorne, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
you got me on that one. Woo! Let's go to our 800 number. Hi there. Who are you?
Good evening, Hawthorne. I first of all want to thank you very much for keeping this forum on the air. And it's also nice to hear callers like Fritz and Bert, who used to tune into Billy Goodman when he was on the air. Very quickly, for Dr. Taff. Dr. Taff, I saw you speak at U Forum in your antimatter lecture and found it fascinating. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Are you familiar with a project that may have been called Looking Glass?
Yes, I am.
To do with the fact of Department of Navy Intelligence Advanced Projects Group, which under, I mean, it had a very vast array of projects, but one of them having to do with taking members of a few highly elite special operation assignment people and making them invisible for periods lasting up to 72 hours?
To my knowledge, Looking Glass had a whole different protocol. It had nothing to do with what you're describing right now.
Okay, it could also have been Project Sapphire. The system that I'm talking about, when you said the thing about the goldfish bowl at China Lake, it rang a few bells. The system supposedly is utilizing some kind of a specialized laser system to bend light around the subjects. And from what I understand, the only drawbacks to it are they suffer from approximately 6 hours of major headaches after it's over and extreme nausea during the time that they're under the process.
These are not the goldfish you're talking about.
No, not the goldfish.
Okay.
You're not aware of this at all?
No, my understanding of Project Looking Glass deals with an entirely different matter.
Okay.
Caller, before we go on, what is your first name?
Mike.
Mike, okay.
Mike. You're not aware, besides forgetting the looking glass thing, you're not aware of any of that taking place?
I'm aware of theoretical stealth technology where they would use artificially generated gravitational fields to bend space and then bend the light in that space so where you wouldn't see something in that space.
Okay. Now, let me break in here for just a second. When Barry, the guest that I had brought in that night, Rich, was Dr. Barry Teff. You remember Barry?
Sure, I know Barry. Yeah. Oh, I knew him. I don't know him actively, but yeah.
Right. And he had written an article for UFO Magazine back in the days when Vicki and I were publishing it, and had suggested that he became aware, was told about a technology that was being developed in secret where... The witness that told Barry about this had witnessed a teleportation of a bowl filled with water and goldfish from one booth to another, just like out of Star Trek, okay? And this was what was being discussed. Now, let's go back to this call.
Okay. Supposedly the system was developed by Dr. Teller. It was evidently some kind of a side effect to the X-ray laser system that he had also developed. But that's all you know about it, though.
Yeah. Don, do you have any background on this at all?
Well, the looking glass, and there's also several other names. As a matter of fact, Barry and I were watching the Bob Lazar tape this afternoon, and several of these project names were mentioned in there from Lazar's alleged time of working out at Site S4 in Nevada. Project Looking Glass involved technology to enable the observers to look back into time.
Exactly.
There was another project called Sidekick, which purportedly involved the use of beam weapons that they were trying to back engineer. And then the project that Lazar himself was involved in was Galileo, which involved back engineering of the propulsion system on these recovered craft. Now, Teller was involved in this as one of the senior scientists that had the knowledge about this. At this time, however, he had retired, and according to what Lazar reported, Teller was now only used as a consultant on this project. He was no longer totally involved. But when he was asked if he knew Lazar, and this is the part that puts a whole different look on this entire situation, he refused to answer. So if Teller didn't know, now we're talking about the man that invented the hydrogen bomb.
Exactly.
If he didn't know Lazar, why not just say, I don't know the man?
Yeah.
You know, this is the whole thing that's so strange about this situation.
Plausible deniability.
Right, exactly.
Okay, well, I thank you both, all three of you very much, and Hawthorne, keep up the good work.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what do you think about that?
Well, it's good to hear Mike's voice again. I'll tell you the truth, you know, you can see what a highly intelligent and well-researched, questions he asked.
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean... He comes prepared. He knows he wants to ask. He's aware of the projects. He's respectful. There's a high degree of in his voice of animation and interest.
Well, you know, just hearing this out of the blue, it just kind of knocked me for a loop.
Yeah, me too. It actually, boy, it takes me back. Having gotten so deeply involved with Mike over the years and getting to observe scenarios I can't explain. I just can't explain. I mean, Mike is still to this day an enigma to me, a very complicated enigma. And like I say, Greg Bishop and I and Steve Polidorus have all talked about maybe sitting down together and writing up you know, a kind of a story about the whole younger experience. And I'm not sure it'll enlighten anybody, but...
Well, let me ask you.
sure. You.
Here's the one question, the only question to me that's relevant about that entire scenario. Was this guy connected?
You know, I wish I could give a yes and no answer on that question, but I really can't, Don. I'm still scratching my head. But I would say the preponderance of evidence and the quality of the research he did and some of the documents he came up with so soon. I mean,
that's the whole thing that blows me away, Rich. That's the whole thing that blows me away.
Yeah, because there are documents now which are staples of the UFO research community. Good, solid documentation. And as far as I know, three or four of those documents, and I have to go and review them, originated into the UFO public forum through Mike Younger. And you go, now, this guy was smart. He was a good researcher. How did he do that? How did he do that? And over the years interacting with him, I have seen, heard, and experienced things that I can't explain. And it's like, this guy is complicated. I don't know what to think of him. It truly enters the realm of the bizarre and the borders on paranormal. I explore every theory and possibility to try to explain the contradictions, and I can't come up with the bottom line.
You know, I had somebody from the forum here on the Paracast ask me a very interesting question. And that was around the time that I put the show up with you, he, and I, okay, back on the old UFOs Tonight.
Yeah.
And this user said, well, how do you know he's dead? Is he really dead? And as a matter of fact, I ask you, Rich, did you go to the funeral?
You know, I have to answer that question with a little bit of guilt. No, I didn't. Steve Polidoros went, and of course his wife and kids were there, and I didn't go. I just couldn't. That's a whole other subject about how intense that was towards the end and how we're all fighting to try to help Mike, who was deteriorating rapidly.
Right.
Physically and emotionally and mentally.
Yeah.
And it was just watching this deterioration accelerate toward the end there, and it was very, very painful to watch.
Well, you know, that's one reason, and if you recall, back in those days, I cautioned you about that,
yeah,
allowing yourself to become too involved. I've always tried to keep at least a half a step away from some of these very involved situations,
yeah,
just as a matter of self-protection.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was in a little bit of a different position and had to make a little bit different choices on that regarding that, you know, as far as my own pursuits go. And, you know, at the time, building on the education I was rapidly getting through being involved with you totally and the leads it led me to. And sometimes, you know, you and Vic would invite me to do a book review. I remember I did a book review on a Roswell book. And, then I did a few more. I kind of put...
And incidentally, your reviews were stellar, Rich. Not
well,
that I'm...
Well, because I had two good mentors to review my work and help me clarify. And that was you and Vicky. And that was part of my educational process, you know. You guys truly helped mentor my understanding. Without it, I would have really been up a creek without a paddle. But I was in a slightly different position in that, having had that education, it just seemed to me that we all at the time knew that the indications were that the government was deeply involved in covering up and actively disinforming the public. We learned that through the William Moore operation, finally and clearly. All that stuff was going on. And it seemed like, well, you know, other than, like I said in an article I wrote, you know, a face-to-face meeting with, Astor Command, you're not going to get much information out of this subject except what the government has created or is hiding, you know. So it all, the roads tend to lead us back to, well, what's the government doing? Because it's obvious to anybody after you see the amount of government indirect participation in the public UFO field that the government's mighty interested in this subject, whatever reasons, you know, psychological, metaphysical, scientific, military, all those reasons, genetic, you know, they are deeply involved in this subject. And it's very hard to kind of peel that layer back. And I thought maybe one of the ways to go at it was to attach myself to somebody who claimed to be speaking as an insider and just see where that took me. It was like getting on a ride going into the tunnel of love. You don't know what you're going to find in that tunnel, but hopefully some love, you know.
Go in with the entrance with girl A, have a liaison with girl B, and then hold girl C's hand on the way out, right?
There you go. You know, so that's the UFO field, you know. What we do know is this. You don't get anywhere by not playing. You know, Greg Bishop and I talked about this. You know, sometimes he gets criticized for his, you know, interacting with the AFOSI and trying to write his book he wrote, you know, on the whole
Benowitz. Paul Benowitz.
Benowitz, the whole Benowitz affair. I mean, Greg has written a very, very revealing book on that subject, Project Beta. And to do that, of course, he talked to AFOSI people, including Doty. And, you know, people take pot shots at you because they go, well, how do you know how to... Well, you don't know nothing if you don't go in there and mix it up and you don't start just gathering intel. If you know, and you serve an intel, Don, you know that. You take all the intel in and you sift it. That's what analysis is about, you know. And that's what the boys sitting at the desk do. They take the intel in, they try to compare it to other intel they got, and they try to build a picture and see what's reliable and what's not. You can't acquire that intel without putting yourself in the field.
Yeah.
And that's different between an analyst and an operative. You know, so basically, you know, as a civilian trying to get into this field and trying to find out what the government knows, the only way you're going to do it is to realize they're holding all the cards, and you're going to play a role in their scenario.
Exactly. You're correct.
I'm going to put myself in this role. I'm going to see where this ride goes.
Well, and Rich, you know, here's something else, too. And I've made this this observation over the years in any number of venues, and I've taken some heat for it. But the bottom line is there are damned few people involved in this research that have a clue or can buy a vowel when it comes to UFO research investigation. Mm-hmm. Now, who are the people that are, at least on the surface, most suited to actually get in there, dig, root around, and come to some conclusions? Well, journalists, okay, is one field where the person is trained to go in and dig out facts. Now, how many journalists are in the UFO research field? Damned few.
Yeah. Vicky was one.
Well, Vicky was a trained journalist, yes. But I'm talking about today.
Yeah.
She has long since basically washed her hands of this whole thing.
Yeah.
But people like George Knapp.
Yeah.
Okay, people like Billy Cox. People like, originally, like Linda Moulton Howe.
Yeah.
Now,
people I have a lot of respect for. And
well,
for the reasons I mentioned.
Linda.
People out there doing the dirty work.
Linda Howe, over the years, I think her standards of proof and her investigative techniques, you know, I'll just come out and say it, have been damned sorely lacking. She's attached herself to some cases that were obviously fraudulent with even the most cursory examination. But who else?
Well, I'm going to say something. I don't know Linda Moulton Howe personally. First of all, I do not know. I've spoken to her several times. Once, you know, interviewing her on your show. Another time, Mike and I interviewed her on KIEV. But I will say this for her, and she's taken a pretty good beating on, you know, her nickname Linda Mutilated Cow and everything else. But again, I have to, you know, give these people respect because they are the ones out there even providing us with the disinformation to consider.
Okay.
In a sense that there is no, to my experience, there's no way around but through. And to go through, you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to kiss a lot of frogs before you find the prince, you know. And maybe you learn something from kissing the frog, just like you do in real life romance, you know.
Well, Linda undoubtedly has kissed a lot of frogs.
Yes. But again, she has. But I mean, I got to give the researcher credit for spending her time and energy and life's blood in a very ungrateful, very financially unrewarding field, to find out for herself and perhaps, you know, throw out there stuff which might make sense to somebody else, even if it doesn't make sense to her. You know, I mean, that's kind of the job of an investigator is, well, you know, I got this. I don't know what to make of it, but here it is.
Yeah.
You know, and that effort. You know what I'm saying? Just the effort and the dedication and get up day after day and keep doing that.
Well, here's the other point that I wanted to make, though, about the people involved in this research. Now, Rich, back when I was involved in it, that's what I did. Mm-hmm. This isn't what I did when I came home from my job at the factory or I finished my shift on the PD.
Yeah, it wasn't a hobby.
Exactly. It's what I did from the time I woke up until I went to bed. It's what my wife did
right.
from the time she woke up until she went to bed. Now,
I'm going to interrupt you right here to say one thing, which is, you know, at this time, here we are approaching 2010, and here you and Vicki have sold the magazine. You've kind of retired from the field, but of course, like we say, our fascination with it continues, you know. At this time in 2010, looking back, we are losing a lot of researchers to old age, retiring, death, you know. And with that, we're losing a tremendous anchor to this field, you know. I think that the role that you and Vicki have as historians is extremely valuable in this field. And the record that you've created through your UFO shows is extremely valuable in this field. It is up to other people to take the data and keep moving it forward. You know, it's funny, going back again to Bill Burns' editorial in this latest UFO magazine. You know, he finally ends with, you know, with a kind of a cynical, I don't know if cynical, but on saying, like Moses and the Israelites roaming in the desert, we will not get to see the promised land in our lifetime. In other words, this will not come out in our lifetime. And that's what Bill's final statement was in this particular editorial. I find that interesting, too, that for a man who is as dedicated as he is, you know, like many of us, you know, like you've spent 20 years and Vicki and I, you know, all of us spent a lot of years, you go, well, we don't have a bottom line, you know?
Well, my bottom line is that there is no bottom line. We'll never know. And I've been saying that myself for some time now. I honestly don't believe that there will ever be a finality to this topic or subject. And, you know, it's funny because back in the early days, I used to think when I was young and naive that with just the right case, with just the right investigation, with just the right amount of dedicated research, this will uncover itself, that someone in the media that makes a damn will become interested, that they will do something to inform the public. And you know what? I was stroking myself, pal.
Yeah, well, you know, we entered in good faith with reasonable expectations of some progress, and then we enter the gauntlet and take the beating.
Exactly.
You know, and that just, you know, reaffirms what I said is like, there's no way out but through. You know, you take the beating because you want to know. I mean, it's just, it's like the old story of Prometheus stealing fire from the gods, you know. What's his reward? To get his liver eaten out every day and then, you know, regrows at night and have it, you know, eaten again the next morning. You know, that's his reward for bringing fire to mankind. You know, the gods don't give up their secrets easily.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. That's a perfect case in point.
Which goes back to Vallée saying that what we may be looking at is what he described in his scientific terms as he could come up with, that what we see is represents kind of a human control system. You know, the outlines of some kind of human control system which leads us down one path as opposed to another path, but never really creating a one clear path.
Well, you know, that's basically, Rich, when I stepped away from it, and it finally gave me some time to do something else I really love and enjoy, which is write. And, you know, this Although I got to tell you, life intrudes sometimes to the point where, you know, I think I'm going to be able to dedicate a day or a week to something, and then I find out I was once again I was mistaken.
Yeah. Life gets in the way.
Yeah, when you're involved with other things.
Yeah. To go back to this whole, you know, I told you I was going to turn the tables on you. Let's just quickly summarize this and became from the break. You know, we talked a little bit, we played that the recording of Mike's business on the show and talking about Operation Looking Glass and you know, there's been rumors around of, you know, time travel experiments happening at China Lake, and, you know, these things are impossible to track down, you know.
And even more impossible to prove one way or the other.
You know, I mean, you know, rumors abound, as they say. And, you know, you may hear from different sources, but you know that those different sources didn't hear from the same imaginary source to start with, so you don't really know anything. it's just, and we hear all these projects and titles and Operation Looking Glass and what they were investigating and how much progress they made, and we don't know how much of that stuff is just pure disinformation, how much is real. It's just, you know, they do their job well.
Well, that's how they keep the public at bay.
I'll be honest with you, Don. You know, and both you and I are both ex-military. You with a lot more, you know, of the real meaning of military than mine, because I never faced combat and never paid the price in blood that you paid, you know, as a soldier. But, you know, still as ex-military, you can't be ex-military without having a certain, you know, reverence for the job of the military, you know, and I know I do. And I have immense respect for our brothers and sisters in arms, you know, and you and I know the price they pay. You know, I sure wouldn't want to do anything to put our soldiers at risk, nor do I mistrust the overall goals. I think, I'm sorry, I just got interrupted for a second to break my train of thought. What do I want to say here? Don, help me get back on track.
You were talking about
work done in the house.
Yeah, you were talking about your respect for the military, and you don't want to do anything.
I sure feel the same way that, you know, brighter, more experienced, better educated minds than you and I were brought in to deal with this subject, you know, way back when, have been, and I'm sure it's a very sacred legacy and treated with, you know, with the importance and significance it's due. There may be very good reasons why this field must be kept in the dark, you know, for the public, in the estimation of these people. So I do not wish to, you know, disrespect that.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take this last break, Rich, and I'll give you an opportunity to collect your thoughts. And when we come back, we will finish up this edition. I might add this brand new edition of Dark Matters Radio. My guest this evening, today, this afternoon, Mr. Richard Saraday. And we'll be back after this. Alrighty, we are back, and Richard, are you still with me, pal?
I'm totally there with you, buddy. Totally there.
Okay. Well, look, this is the last segment of the show, and while we're busy collecting our thoughts and everything here, was there anything you wanted to to jump into before we...
You and I share a lot. I've spent a lot of hours talking about this subject together, and you know, and we have discussed, you know, in the previous hour, you know, a lot of that relationship. So I don't have to go back over that again. But I'd like to turn the tables on you a little bit, and you know, hear some of your, you know, maybe let me take you out of your shoes as a just a hardcore, you know, ex-military, ex-police trained SWAT team member, you know, just the facts, ma'am, guy, to, you know, allow you to step out of that role and just be Don Ecker, another one of us, you know, incredibly curious human beings. not that that excludes the other. But from that viewpoint, in other words, not to lock you into speaking, this is kind of off the record, so to speak, or like just not supported by evidence, what is your feeling about what we're looking at as far as the subject of this other intelligence that seems to be interacting with us?
You mean,
you know, what we call the UFO phenomena? What, you know, what did you have, is there any way for you to...
My speculation?
Yeah, your speculation, that's all.
Boy. It's been some time since I've allowed myself to go down that road, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Well, okay. If I had to speculate about this phenomenon, here is my speculation. First off, do I believe this is real? Absolutely, without a doubt. And why do I say that? Could I, and you mentioned my background as law enforcement, could I go into court and swear to those facts? No, I couldn't. Simply because I don't, and this is something the skeptics are very fond of saying, I don't have that alien ashtray, okay?
Yeah.
I don't have that alien roll of toilet paper, if they even use it. I mean, but, you know, I've been privy to, over the years, some cases that suggested that at least some of these appear, for all intents and purposes, to be from somewhere else. However, my speculation, I would have to say, Rich, that I speculate that this phenomena has been with humanity in one form or another for as long as there has been a humanity. Now, what does that mean? Well, it could mean that we, the human race, Homo sapiens sapiens, we are here because of that intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I think that over the years, there have been a number of very intelligent people that have looked at this question and came to some conclusions that would seem to suggest, at least in some cases, that the human race has been genetically modified or engineered. I think that's possible. Could I prove it? No. But I think that's very, very possible.
Yeah.
I think that I speculate, that there has been a very long-term project for God knows how long and for God knows what purpose that these intelligences have been staying close by and monitoring us as a collective species. I speculate that.
Yeah, well...
Now, oh, there's more. I mean, you ask.
Can I interrupt you just for a minute? Can we go to pause for a second?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so we had a brief interruption. We are back, and Richard, before this interruption thing came up, I was basically telling you what I was speculating about, so let me briefly finish up. So, at any rate, let me recap. I think that the phenomenon has been here for a very long time, at least as long as there have been human beings. I think that it's very conceivable, possible even, that the human race has been, if nothing else, manipulated by these intelligences. And now I'm going to get to a very controversial speculation on my part.
All right.
I think that it's very possible, and without going into a lot of detail, over the years from some very highly placed researchers within the UFO research field, it's also conceivable that these intelligences have been here with us, among us, for a long time. Perhaps, like if you recall back in your high school days, a high school monitor, if you will.
Yeah.
I think it's possible that, you know, that these, and incidentally, I believe that at least from all outward appearances, at least some of these intelligences appear just as human as you or I. Now, you know, one thing that the skeptics might quickly point out is that this universe is a vast, vast enterprise, no pun intended. And in such a vast, vast area, how would it be conceivable that there would be beings from somewhere else that would look as much like you or I as anybody else on this planet? Well, I answer that question by saying, number one, that if, in fact, any of this is true, it's conceivable that we are the reason we look like we do because of them.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
In the ultimate sense, it just begs the question, because if some other species or if some other form of intelligence that we see as foreign to us, that is perhaps not so foreign, but not necessarily in our world the way we are, you know, what does that mean? It means if they had a hand in creating us, so to speak, then who had a hand in creating them, et cetera? It becomes the almost the old Aristotelian argument of the uncaused cause, philosophically.
Yeah.
In other words, if there's a great chain of cause and effect that represents the physical universe, then everything in it comes from something previous to it, comes from something previous to it, comes from something previous to it. There's still an uncaused cause.
What's first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, you know, that's a question unanswerable. However, with quantum physics, it becomes both clearer and more obscure, because what you see in the argument of quantum physics is that the universe is moment by moment being created and sustained by organizing mental principles. You know, so in other words, does the world, on one sense, happen in a cause and effect level, and in another level, it's happening just ad hoc, moment by moment, emerging out of forces that are unseen to us, but whose underpinnings are the foundation of our reality, which is the whole subject of quantum physics. So whether things happen in a linear manner, and that's the ultimate truth, or whether the linear manner is an expression of its expression in three dimensions, and that in reality everything's happening at once, becomes one of those impossible, you know, arguments for our minds to contain. Yet we are faced with these contradictions every day. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does.
You know, so, I mean, like, when religious people get in the argument, whether it's Darwinian argument of, like, you know, I didn't descend from no monkey, or the earth is 5,742 years old, I can tell, because I can figure it out from the Bible.
Right.
No.
I do not discount that spark of the divine, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that that I certainly do not discount. Now, what do I mean by the divine? Well, that all-encompassing energy that holds the universe together. I mean, you can call it any one of a billion names,
yeah.
But I believe that that divine spark is present, and that's what I personally believe, okay?
Well, you know, can I share with you something I really haven't shared before? And it's you know, it's part of a picture of me, so for the audience, take that in hand and consider it, and dismiss it if they feel like it. But in the 70s, I got involved, you know, early on with meditation and well, I guess you call it the whole area of seeking, a personal spiritual truth, having been raised and honored a Catholic upbringing right through high school, and then coming to a place where I felt like I needed more answers and better answers and et cetera, and went on my own search, which led me, of course, like many of my generation, through Eastern mysticism, and eventually I worked with the Edgar Cayce Foundation and learned, had a weekly study group, and we'd meditate together. And during that time in the early 70s, over the course of learning what meditation might mean and, you know, the actual practice of it, of sitting still and trying to still your mind and when you find thoughts running through it, noticing that and becoming more identified with the witnessing part of you than the thinking part of you, so to speak, and gradually calming that thinking part down, et cetera, which is the process of meditation. On one level, there's many other processes going on, which some are physiological, how it affects your body and the brain and everything else and the release of chemicals through the pineal gland, et cetera. Which may have more to do with the UFO subject than maybe apparent at the beginning, but that's a side we can take up later. The point I'm trying to make to you, my personal experience, though, is I had a chance to meet an Eastern guru through a friend of mine in the Edgar Cayce Foundation, and I asked if she was going to study with him and live in his little ashram up in Northern California. And I said, you know, I'd like to meet one of these guys, who I've read about and described as enlightened masters, and just kind of check that out. And so a few months down the road, she invited me up to meet him, and I spent some time with him. And he was from India, and he was not one of these big, high-profile gurus you see on television. He had come very quietly to the West Coast, sent by the Ananda Marga Foundation, which is a huge yoga foundation in India. He was one of their priests who went through their, processes of enlightenment with their lineage of gurus, some who are in the body and some who are not, if you know that tradition. But long and short of it is, just I had to give that background, is that I asked him, I said, I'm very torn right now on my path between, continuing this hard trek as an actor. This is in the mid-70s when work was slow and hard to come by, and I was mainly a waiter. And the spiritual path, which had always been, a big part of my consciousness ever since I was a kid. So he said, let me think on it. And that night, I stayed at the house, which was a big old house in San Rafael, California. And, there was about five or six people living there. And so I got to stay in a walk-in closet in my sleeping bag. You know, it was a big empty closet. So it was a nice place for me to just put down and sleep that night. Well, sometime in the wee hours of the morning, I had this experience, which is very hard to describe. I thought I woke up, become kind of semi-conscious, and I found myself laying on my back with bright light all around me, and I could see tall, shadowy figures, and they were like standing around, the head of the table and behind me, so to speak, and they were talking, and I couldn't quite make out everything that was going on, but it seemed almost like surgery or something.
You were semi-conscious?
Yeah, I was kind of semi-conscious, like coming aware of this going on, and and these beings, kind of there, that's all I can say. And I was getting up very early, and the girl who introduced me to the ashram was going to get me up, because every morning they meditated at 6 a.m., and I found it very hard if I just woke up to, stay awake. I wasn't an experienced yoga practitioner, and I wasn't an experienced meditator, and I'd find myself just dozing off to sleep. Meanwhile, I've got these hardcore, people doing physical yoga with Dadaji on a daily basis, plus intense meditation and everything else to hasten their enlightenment, so to speak, which is what the path is about. So she comes in to get me up, I said, get me up early so we can go for a walk, and I can walk around the outside and get some fresh air, before we sit down and meditate. And so she did, and I don't know if I was slept. But we went for a walk. She said, how'd you sleep? And I said, well, it was very strange. I had this very strange experience, and I described it to her. And she kind of looked at me. We're walking back to the house, and she says, oh, my God, you remember that? And I said, well, yeah. And then she didn't say another thing, and she kind of went ahead of me inside, and nothing was ever said about it. And it always kind of hung in my mind, like, what the hell was that about, And so then later comes the whole abduction scenarios, and people describe lying on tables and having beings around them and things like that. And I'm going, is that what happened? I had that while I was visiting this ashram. What's all that about, And I just tossed around my mind for many, many, many years. And then finally, about a year ago, believe it or not, I decided to look at it with a hypnotist. The results were not what I expected. Hypnotism, of course, that's a whole other discussion. But I got in a very relaxed state and guided by this very qualified, certified hypnotist. And went back to that experience. And what I experienced was not at all what I expected. I don't know what my expectations were, but I was kind of bracing myself for some, like, maybe this is some kind of abduction scenario with the grays or something. I don't know, you know. But instead what I got was, it's hard to even describe. It becomes very profoundly emotional. And hard to describe. But
and very personal.
I think it has some fruit to bear on us.
And very personal.
Very personal. One I experienced was, I was laying on the table, and I was overwhelmed, just overwhelmed, not just with the light, but in the light there was, how can I describe it? This flowing sense of loving, it's just, there's no words for it. Loving kindness, and yet a rigor behind it, a kind of a almost steel-hard rigor behind it, and at the same time an extreme loving kindness that is beyond anything you can imagine, anything a human being can imagine. This sense of like, there's nothing but this tremendous loving kindness presence that just radiates with so much intensity that it just washes out anything dark, anything that you'd want to hang on to, any doubt, any self-recrimination, any guilt, and it's like what it was going on was this kind of tug of war between my mind and these beings, me not feeling like I could really let go and just allow myself to merge into this feeling. I felt so humbled by it and unworthy of it. That's so strange to say, but you feel unworthy. You feel like it's too much. You want to hide from it. At the same time, you want to embrace it, but you can't let go of the stuff that, I guess, your stuff, you know. I'll describe it. And there's this tug of war going on. And what kept coming is I was saying, you know, no. How can this be? How can you? We're just so pathetic compared. Oh, compared to this light. I mean, it was these terrible feelings of one second of incredible resistance to it and unworthiness, and the next second just being washed away by it. It's an interesting tug of war. And the sense was at the time I had the experience too, not in the recall of it, but when I had it. But there was quote-unquote work being done on my quote-unquote system. You know, I don't know what that means exactly. I have some theories on it. But that was what came out under the hypnosis session. And it was a profoundly powerful experience because it rooted me back in the sense of that, what you call the divine spark or whatever, that behind all this there is something that is so indescribable, so magnificent, and so full of what we experience as this heartfelt love. It's beyond what you can imagine.
Well, you know, Rich, I can only ever recall one time I had an experience somewhat like that. Not what you experienced, but in December of 1971, when I was still in Vietnam, I had what ended up being a death in my family. And to make a long story short, I came back from Vietnam to my home state of Pennsylvania on an emergency leave. And I was back there. I got back before my family member. It was my grandfather before he died. But he had a catastrophic heart attack. Now, I got to tell you, I was extraordinarily close to him. I mean, we were not just grandfather-grandson, we were best friends.
Really?
And his entire life, my entire life, I should say, he had been somebody to try to measure up to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And anyway, he passed away the 1st of January. So the day of the funeral, I was just heartbroken and crushed. I mean, I could barely get through the funeral. And we came back to my grandmother's home. And, you know, they have traditions back there, funerals. The people at the funeral will come back to the house. They bring gifts of food and what have you and, you know, visit.
Yeah.
And it was too much for me, and I went into their guest bedroom and laid down in the bed and broke down. I literally broke down. I was just crying. And I got most of that out of my system, and I went to sleep. And suddenly, something caused me to open my eyes. I opened my eyes, still very broken up. And I was engulfed by what to me seemed to be like a very soft blue light that grew somewhat brighter. And I always thought to myself that it was my granddad saying goodbye to me. And suddenly I felt an incredible peace and a calming come over me. And it was a rather extraordinary, it was a very extraordinary thing that happened. And when it was all said and done, you know, I ended up going back to Vietnam, and that's another story. But that was one of the most profound things that ever happened to me.
Well, you know, you just said a peace came over you, you know? You know, the I don't know if it's in the Bible somewhere, the peace that passeth understanding, to put it in, you know, the English translation, the peace that passeth understanding, that would be the best way I could describe my experience, that it's larger than any pain inside of you. It's bigger, it swallows it up, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That peace that comes, and it just swallows up everything. God, I you know, it's very interesting. We're talking about UFOs, and now we're talking about personal kind of transformative experiences, or glimpses at a greater reality, whatever you want to call it. But it's strange that we start off talking about UFOs, and somehow we always end up having to deal with this area too, you know, which is all I tell people when you talk about UFOs. I say, well, you know, you say, do you believe in UFOs? And I go, well, that question would depend on what you mean by your question.
Well, actually, that's a very unenlightened question.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like, well, what does that question even mean? I often tell people, you know, I kind of went into this area thinking I was entering a boutique. I'm going to go, you know, develop properties and learn about UFOs and about this thing, because I think there's something to it. And I'm going to develop stuff for TV and film and maybe books on this subject, because that fascinates me, and I could see spending the time and effort it takes to do that. Yeah, I got a picture of what I'm going to find. You know, I think I have a picture of what I'm going to find. At least I know it's going to be true, and they direct the terrestrials, you know. Yet, you go in with that thing, think you're going to a little boutique, and you find yourself entering Walmart. I mean, it's like there's so much to consider here, and it's all kind of, the edges are fuzzy between the different distinct areas. They all kind of blend together, where you're talking about ancient astronauts, or modern ghosts, or UFOs, or cryptozoology, the association of Yetis with the UFOs. I mean, it all kind of blends together in one big kind of ball of goo that, I can see where minds like Sherman and them go, well, this is just a bunch of hokum spokum,
right,
product of people's imagination, confusion, and psychological pressures, and let's get down to the rock core, hardcore, the rational truth here. You know, let's be enlightenment people here, and let's cut through this fog of superstition, you know, which is all it is. And yet, when people take that stance, they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You know that the truth is more subtle and lies somewhere across both positions.
Well, you would be hard pressed, Richard, and I think you'll agree with this, to find somebody more hard headed or skeptical than I am.
Right.
But that is not to say that I don't recognize that there is, beyond any doubt in my mind, a larger truth out there that we are not presently, for whatever reason, able to grasp.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's like we have to grow to it. I think we have to just grow to it.
And perhaps the whole, you know, at one point during this program, we discussed briefly reincarnation.
Yeah.
Perhaps it truly is in some respect, a growing thing. Perhaps we are going throughout time, and we are basically learning not only about ourselves, but about the universe.
Yeah. And the unique position and point of view that the human species has is unique to it.
Exactly. Well, you know what, my friend? This has been a fascinating hour and a half.
Damn straight. Interesting.
And I think we are just about done today.
Well, you know, let me just make a concluding statement on you know, I've asked you to speculate, and you opened up quite personally about it. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be people listening to the show, and we'll find fault with that. Because they will find fault with everything, you know. But I think it's very worthwhile because ultimately, you know, for any of us, and like you put all these years in the field, and I have, and you know, that with a dollar will get you a cup of coffee, right?
Really, buck and a half.
But, there are some fruits to our labor, but they are personal fruits, and they are the ones that fit into our personal searches and our personal needs and our personal aspirations. And I think that's what's so amazing about this area is that it one of the difficult things about unraveling it is that you're starting to unravel into, when you're unraveling, into areas of the human mind and the human species that we're only dimly aware of and mostly symbolically and metaphorically aware of, and yet we're coming to a time where we're more directly aware of it. I remember, just to tie up again, I was asking Dadaji, I said, you know, I understand that, you know, you meditated and achieved your enlightenment in this lifetime, and that you, at one point they sent you off to meditate in a cave in the mountains in the Himalayas. And he said, yes. And I said, well, it's hard for me to picture. I mean, what do you do? You go off by yourself in a cave and you just don't do anything? You just sit and meditate and do nothing? And he very quietly looked at me and says, well, what makes you think I'm doing nothing? And when he said that, suddenly my head filled with images of all this activity going on, like beings flying around, and I saw many different kinds of just images, including that familiar-looking big-eyed, slant-eyed creature we call the gray, but just like feeding images of all this activity going on, everything very busy on a kind of a invisible level of beings doing all these kind of agendas and supporting what's happening on stage like they're off stage. I can't, it just kind of, it's like this rush of information that just came as a set of images and was gone like that, and I was just going like, ugh. You know, but that's often the way these teachers teach, and you they it's and so what I would say to tie it all up is that I agree with you, Don, that behind all this there is a greater truth, and that we're only beginning dimly to become aware of in a more less symbolic and a more concrete level, and it's only going to, I think, enrich and open up the human potential. And I think it's the destiny of the human being to reunite with that awareness and to grow to it at the same time. And that in that process, which we've seen unfolding for the history of mankind, you know, there are, it's a process. There's no way out but through, you know, as a species. And I think it's very interesting that our science, our attention of our minds, with the progress that humanity has made in extending lives and having more control over our own health and destinies and everything else, it's advancing at a ridiculously fast pace. Our knowledge of the fundamental building blocks of matter and of reality, you know, we're learning more and more about it. And, of course, that's a two-edged sword because knowledge can be used to advance or retard people.
Well, Richard, let me tell you what vision literally just shot through my mind.
What's that?
Kwai Chang Kain and his flute. Remember David Carradine in Kung Fu?
Yeah.
He's on his journey. My friend, that is it for now. Stand by, if you will, Rich. And in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, until next time, remember, keep those eyes to the skies.